with some kind of a class. I'm not sure what exactly I'm going to do, but and then we're restarting like the main class on the 12th of September. Our class that we've been looking at related to the English Bible and other things. So what we're doing here with this topic isn't wholly, obviously, unrelated to what we've seen or done with the greater Bible topic. So twice this month I've taught on this, and I've just simply called this Codex Sinaiticus Research Update. And I'm not going to repeat everything I said in the first two, but in the first study that I did earlier this month, we talked about the color of the parchment, and we're looking at whether or not the argument that the Codex is a 19th century forgery is accurate. And I want to say again at the beginning that for me, it doesn't matter to me if it's a 19th century forgery or an old document. It doesn't make any difference to me. I've never accepted it as a true witness to the reliability of the New Testament text. I feel, you know, there are other reasons why it's corrupt and the readings of it are reject them. Irregardless of whether or not this controversy regarding its age could be settled. So for me, all my eggs are not into this basket. This was an interesting point that came up for me in 2017 that I spent a considerable amount of time reading about, researching, etc. Taught about it for six studies back in 2017, June and July of 2017. Taught about it at the Bible conference in April 2018, and then I've got two more that we've done just this month on kind of updating some things. So if you remember what I told you back in January 2019, I kind of marked all this stuff private. And the reason I did it was because I was handed some materials that I had read that caused me to kind of think I maybe needed to pump the brakes on that a little bit until I kind of saw more of what transpired and if anybody was going to come forward with any kind of answers to some of these things that were giving me pause. And so August 8th, I taught about what color is the parchment. And then 2 weeks ago, on the 15th of August, we looked at was Simonides trustworthy? And so those are some things that we looked at. Today, what I want to get to is some things about some of the people involved and just some of the other points that have been raised by some of the authors, particularly Kevin McGrain, about why the 19th century forgery view is not necessarily correct. Okay. Now, I didn't bring all the books with me. I've covered all those books in other places. I've set them out for you in chronological order as far as the different books that have been written. And what I'm going to be working off of here mostly is this document here, a review of the forging of Codex Sinaiticus by Dr. William Cooper against detailed background of the discovery of the Codex by Kevin McGrain, and this was published in 2018. Description underneath this video, especially particularly on YouTube. Now, if you go back all the way to the very first lesson I ever taught on this in June of 2017, one of the things that I have said from the beginning is that one of the things I don't like about the books that have been written about this is I personally find them to be too conspiratorial. Okay? There's too many moving pieces that all have to just, you know, line up in the right way to make a lot of these accounts work, okay? Now, I don't deny the fact that the Jesuits, for example, were the enemies of the Protestant movement and that they did a lot of things to try to undermine Protestantism in Europe and then later in the United States. But as I read through the different books, the book by Dr. Cooper, Sorensen, David Daniels, the different books that have been written, there was always an element of it where in order for the story to work the way that it was being told, everything had to just fall into place just so, all right? And one of the things that Kevin McGrain deals with in his critique of all of this is this issue of conspiracy theories, okay? Now, listen, I know that the Bible uses the word conspiracy. There are conspiracies. There have been conspiracies. The issue is, you know, how do you judge what's a legitimate conspiracy versus an illegitimate conspiracy? And all of the writings that have been done on this idea of a 19th century forgery have some element of conspiracy to them. Now, they might be different. They might see the conspiracy differently. They all sort of have their own theory. But one of the problems with conspiracy theories is that you only tend to look at the evidence that would support the theory that you've already decided is the case, while you ignore, if not discredit, other evidence that might call into question whether that theory that you're working off of is actually true. Okay? Now, McGrane deals with this starting on page 6 of his critique of Dr. Cooper's book. Now, he says, so I'm going to read some things and explain a few things as we get started here. So, the whole idea, what he's going to say is in relationship to the whole idea that Constantine Simonides created the Codex at Athos, Greece in 1840, 1841. Tischendorf finds it, and it's really a new document that has been passed off to the world as an ancient document. And Dr. Cooper, in his rendition of the story, actually has Tischendorf complicit in the deception and doing different things to the document itself to try to facilitate the idea that it's old. Okay, and here's what he says about this. He says, this is an elaborate, so I'm reading from page 6. This is an elaborate conspiracy, to be sure, but since it is certain that the Church of Rome has been engaged in innumerable plots and conspiracies in the past, a suspicion of conspiracy cannot be dismissed out of hand without examination. So, is McGrane acknowledging the fact that the Roman Catholic Church has been involved in many provable conspiracies in the past? Okay? So, that's not in dispute. Rome has done that. The Jesuits have been involved in many different things throughout history. I'm not denying that they have. The issue is, just because they have been involved in different things in the past, does that mean they were orchestrating this situation here with Codex Sinaiticus? Okay? But, since Dr. Cooper's thesis that there was a forging of Codex Sinaiticus is not a revealed truth, then it is only rightly be established on the grounds that are evidence-based. For such a thesis to be credible, there needs to be a collection of facts that provide evidence for a conclusion that follows from application of sound methodology. The facts must inform the thesis. A pre-existing opinion that drives a search for supporting facts is a weak approach and especially prone to bias. So in other words, if I decide that it's a forgery, and now I go out and can I find stuff that I can interpret now that support the idea that it's a forgery? If it truly is a forgery, then we need to be able to marshal independent evidence that suggests that it was in fact a what? Forgery, not cherry-pick things that can then be collected to make a particular theory sound good. Ideally, a thesis should be proposed by someone knowledgeable in the subject, but at the very least, the facts and inferences drawn should be checked with experts in the relevant fields. Steps should be taken to minimize confirmation bias. Finally, the thesis should make clear what evidence would falsify it and address proposed falsifying evidence. So let me just say, when we teach kids in my school to write in history, one of the things we teach them to do is acknowledge the counter arguments. So if I'm going to make an argument that I think is true, I have to not only be able to put forth that argument, but I have to acknowledge also who's out there that might make a counter what argument. And I also need to be able to address that and be able to say, here's the counter argument, here's why the counter argument's wrong, and here's why I think my view is what? Is correct, right? That's the appropriate way of handling things. Especially when a thesis concerns a conspiracy, as in this case, and departs from these principles, it drifts inextricably into the ambit of conspiracy theory, generating excuses for not meeting minimum standards of evidence. Such excuses claim, for example, that one cannot consult recognized experts to check facts and inferences because those who are recognized experts are also part of the conspiracy. So you can't check who you would go to check because they're all complicit in the what? In the conspiracy, okay? And those who recognize them as experts do so because they themselves are involved in the conspiracy. All have a motive to hide the truth, giving out disinformation and withholding facts. Now, this is a major problem in our just broader culture right now, is it not? Like, you know, masks and viruses and vaccines, and, you know, no one knows who's telling the truth, right? And you got all manner of different opinions about who's telling the truth and what's going on, right? So we can all kind of relate to this. It's not my intention to get into a conversation right now about which epidemiologist you think is right, because who knows? But anyway, but as we shall see, it is a conspiracy theorist himself who hides the truth, withholds information, and purveys disinformation. Moreover, any critical analysis of the claims of his thesis is viewed as part of the conspiracy. If this analysis is unfavorable. So this is what happens with conspiracies. Well, if you are critical of the conspiracy theory, that's the problem. You're part of the conspiracy. Especially if you're negative about it or you question it. Okay. In short, this kind of methodology is fatally flawed because nearly everything can be shaped into being part of the conspiracy, reinforcing the particular conspiracy theory and making falsification impossible in the eyes of the conspiracy theorist. To brand any thesis concerning conspiracy a conspiracy theory at the outset is to rob it of credibility before giving it a fair hearing. Nevertheless, we should weigh carefully that accepting a false conspiracy as true comes at a great cost. Not merely intellectually, but in credibility, in the cause of truth, and in the health of prosperity of the church and success of the church's ministry. Okay? Now, so what he's saying here is, when you evaluate what's going on, you have a lot of convenient interpretations of data that are interpreted such a way to as fit what this particular person is trying to say, what they want to get you to believe. Okay? And there are many things that Dr. Cooper said in his book that are just absolutely factually, demonstrably not true. They're not the case, okay? So, going on page 7, he says, it is to be noted that in Dr. Cooper's scheme, Tischendorf is aware that his role is deceptively to present as ancient what he knows to be a recent forgery, and he is himself involved in deliberately tampering with the manuscript to destroy evidence pointing to its recent production. So, the theories of Cooper and others have Tischendorf aware of what he's doing and tampering with the document in such a way so as to hide from the world that it is actually a recent what? Forgery. A recently produced document. The difficulty that Dr. Cooper faces in establishing such a thesis is that he can produce no actual evidence that Tischendorf believed the codex was forged. When we look at Tischendorf's communications, not only his published writings, but his private letters, or indeed reports by others of conversations with him, we find not the slenderest evidence that Tischendorf ever expressed an opinion or doubt that Codex Sinaiticus was anything other than genuinely ancient. Circumstantial evidence might lend weight to actual evidence, but without actual evidence, any attribution of foul play would be unsafe. Now, particularly David Daniels, in his two books, I think he does a very good job in demonstrating that Tischendorf was kind of an opportunist, that he wasn't necessarily of the highest impeccable character. It's pretty clear to me that Tischendorf also lied about certain elements of his story. But what he never said was, this is a really a recent document, and I'm involved in the cover-up of the forgery. Okay. Moreover, no qualified paleographer who has had opportunity physically to inspect the document has doubted the manuscript was produced centuries before the 19th. Dr. Cooper may consider that Tischendorf had ulterior motives in passing off as genuine what he knew to be a fake, and that he was a willing accomplice of the Vatican. However, similar dishonorable motives cannot be attributed to all of the experts in all generations and countries since then. Indeed, if one wishes to advance a hypothesis that Codex Sinaiticus is a 19th century forgery, then in order to avoid falling into the trap of conspiracy theory, one would need to maintain that experts since 1844 have been universally mistaken because the alleged forgery was brilliantly executed. A conspiracy theorist, on the other hand, would maintain that forgery is widely and secretly acknowledged among the experts, but universally denied by them publicly as part of the conspiracy. But since Dr. Cooper refuses to countenance that the alleged forgery is brilliantly executed, he reportedly states that there are, quote, telltale signs of forgery on nearly every page that are, quote, very amateurishly done, and thus blindingly obvious to any expert. He voluntarily and firmly positions himself in the camp of the conspiracy theorists. All the experts can see that it is fake, but are deliberately suppressing the facts. Okay? So that's what Cooper is arguing basically in his book. And I'm just going to go one more thing here on this, and then we'll move on to the next thing I want to cover. As for there being a genuine conspiracy, we are obligated to point out that Dr. Cooper's proposal would be well below standard for a Jesuit plot having the full backing of the Vatican. At the very least, in the planning of such a conspiracy, two important elements would be necessary to be maintained. Number one, to ensure that the appointed scribe was never in a position to reveal his role in being commissioned to create the codex of the whole Bible on expensive parchment. And number two, to ensure that the scribe would never identify as his own the modified and distressed version of his work. So in other words, if they hired somebody to do this, would they have ever allowed this guy to go out and make a public claim in the newspaper of the deception? Okay? However, since according to Dr. Cooper's thesis, the scribe was to be kept entirely ignorant of the alleged Jesuit scheme, he would have no indication of motive to hide his role in producing such a splendid work and might reveal his commission at any time. Moreover, the distressed work would likely come to his attention if it were blazed abroad as a great discovery. It does not appear that any effective preventative measures were taken to keep the two main factors, Simonides and Tischendorf, apart. On the contrary, it was likely that they would interact, for they were both scouring the world for ancient manuscripts, the former to sell and the latter for academic purposes. Moreover, a number of incidents occurred, any one of which would blow apart the conspiracy proposed by Dr. Cooper, demonstrating inept execution. For example, according to Dr. Cooper's thesis, Tischendorf arrives at St. Catherine's Monastery not according to the Jesuit plan, but fully 15 years early, and not according to the plan, saw the manuscript openly, and not according to the plan, carried away with him a portion of the codex that looked nothing like as old as it ought to have done, if according to the plan, because the alleged work of distressing had not been started. Furthermore, surely not according to the plan, no satisfactory attempt has been made to prevent important visitors seeing the codex during the 1840s and 50s and being able to report publicly on what they had seen. As indeed did happen, surely not according to the plan. If indeed find a way to remove the manuscript before Tischendorf, which could well have happened if the Russian government had followed Uspensky's advice, see below, it seems then that Dr. Cooper's thesis silently concedes that the Vatican and the Jesuits had grossly inept planning and execution and lost control of their plot in 1844 at the latest. And yet, he can imagine Jesuit forgers secretly embedded in the Orthodox monastery in Sinai, soldiering on undetected in disaster recovery mode, producing a codex that could bear timely witness to Vaticanus. You guys following all this? Probably not. So, the problem is there are major issues for the conspiracy theory. So in other words, all of the pieces had to happen according to plan, yet all of these things were outside of the parameters of what the alleged plan would have been. Okay? Is everybody with me? Now, next thing I want to do is I want to talk about a guy named Uspensky. Okay? Now, Porfiry Uspensky, I've mentioned him before, and those of you that were with me, he goes to the St. Catherine's Monastery after Tischendorf took the first 43 leaves, and he's there in 1845, and he sees the remainder of the work that Tischendorf didn't take. So I'm going to skip ahead now. And I want to make a point about Uspensky. It is seldom appreciated that all 347 leaves of the Codex of the monastery had in its room and brought to Tischendorf's attention in 1859, which Tischendorf eventually removed to St. Petersburg and named Codex Sinaiticus, were thoroughly examined in 1845 and 1850 by Uspensky. Okay, so I'm going to try to draw this out here on the board. Okay, so in 1844, is it 44 or 43? I got so many numbers kicking around in my head. I think it's 44. Tischendorf takes 43 leaves to Germany. Okay? Does everybody remember that? In 1845, a Russian Orthodox monk named Uspensky he goes to the monastery at St. Catherine's and he sees the remaining leaves. He sees the remaining leaves. And then he sees them again in 1850. So that's Uspensky. He sees them again in 1850. Okay? So let me read that again. It is seldom appreciated that all 347 leaves of the Codex that the oikonomos of the monastery had in his room and brought to Tischendorf's attention in 1859, which Tischendorf eventually removed to St. Petersburg and named Codex Sinaiticus, were thoroughly examined in 1845 and 1850 by Uspensky. Okay? So it's 1859 that Tischendorf takes the remaining 315 leaves and he takes them where? He takes them into Russia. Okay? So in between the time when Tischendorf finds the first 43 leaves and takes them to Germany, and the time when he gets his hands on the rest of the Codex in 1859, has this Russian Orthodox monk been to St. Catherine's Monastery twice and seen the Codex in the intermittent years? Okay, now let's see what he says about this.
Did they not know that there were 315 more in 44 when he took the 44?
So, I will give Daniels a lot of credit on this point. His latest book does an excellent job making the case that Tischendorf cut these 43 pages out of a bound codex. He stole them, basically. So, Tischendorf is not without repute in all of this, okay? But his motivation is to be the discoverer of a great codex. His motivation is not necessarily working as, now of course Daniel says and argues that he's an agent of the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church has the Vatican manuscript and they want another manuscript to go with it so they can, you know, change the Bible, kind of a concept, okay? If we have time, I'll say kind of what my thoughts are on that, but let's just go back to this, okay? So Uspensky's detailed examination in 1845 was of what remained of the Codex following Tischendorf's removal of the 43 leaves the previous year. So I was right, it was 1844, okay? He saw the 74 leaves that Tischendorf had seen but was unable to remove, plus 273 leaves that Tischendorf was not permitted to see until 1859, comprising the Minor Prophets, the Psalms, the Wisdom Literature, the whole of the New Testament, the Epistle of Barnabas, the Shepherd of Hermas. And on his 1845 visit, Uspensky also found a fragment from the Book of Genesis from the Codex, so inferred that the Codex was at one time a complete Bible. So Uspensky's seeing all this the year following Tischendorf being there in 1844. Okay, on the first examination, Uspensky was well aware that the New Testament differed markedly from the received text, but he initially considered that it was nothing more than a sinister, it was nothing more sinister, excuse me, than a poor job of copying from poor exemplars. So, in 1845, does Uspensky see all of this stuff that Tischendorf sees in 1859? Shake your head yes, because that's what happened. Everybody's with me, right? Praise the Lord. Okay. So, 1845, Uspensky goes and he sees the remaining leaves in Russia. He makes some conclusions, okay? He concludes that it was originally part of a bound codex. And he originally thinks that this is just a poor copy from poor exemplars. But notice what he doesn't say. Does he say this is a 19th century forgery? No. He doesn't say that. He believes it to be what? Old. Okay? Now understand, this is an important point because all of the defenders of the 19th century forgery view are heavily reliant on Uspensky and his observations to make their points. Okay? But now Uspensky is not of the opinion that this is a 19th century forgery. He thinks it's an old book. A poor copy from poor exemplars, and it was originally part of a bound codex. Okay? Bottom of page 40 of McGrane. Uspensky visited again in 1850, and from June to August cataloged the manuscripts at St. Catherine's, during which time he sought out the Codex Sinaiticus manuscript and continued his study of it for a, quote, long time. On his second review of the codex, Uspensky became very concerned about what he suspected were its heterodox origins. So in other words, what does heterodox mean? Anybody know? Heterodox would mean, the opposite of orthodox. So heterodox would mean like, the word's escaping me. Heretical. So in 1850, he spends a bunch of time with it. He changes his mind. He says it's not just a poor copy from a poor exemplar. Now he says the thing has its origin from people who were what? Heretics. Who were intentionally now altering what? The text. Okay, so let me read that again.
One question. In 45, this was at a monastery that was...
Yeah, all this is happening.
Did the monastery staff know that it was old?
That's a good question. So, my understanding of that, Bart, is in 1844, it's out there and Tischendorf sees it. He asks if he can have it. He asks if he can, you know, have some of it, and they tell him no. At which time he takes out a knife and he cuts out 43 leaves.
No. Wasn't it discarded actually by the monastery? Where did he find it?
That story is through Tischendorf, and he tells it years later that he found it in a waste bin, in the middle, in the open part of the library, ready to be burned. Okay?
And was that true? I mean, was that ever debunked?
I think David Daniels does do a good job with saying and proving why Tischendorf was lying about that. Okay? But that's a whole other thing. So Bart, at that point, they maybe don't really realize the significance of what they have until they realize that Tischendorf stole 43 leaves. Then it's my understanding that they moved that into the prior cells, into the chambers of the monks that were living in the monastery. And so when Tischendorf comes back again in 1853 looking for the rest of it, but he can't find it because they've hidden it away in the prior cells. Now this Uspensky guy, he's a Russian Orthodox monk, and St. Catherine's Monastery was associated with the Russian Orthodox Church. So he's not a German Lutheran like Tischendorf, so they're gonna trust this guy more than they trust Tischendorf. And when Tischendorf comes back in 1859, he comes back under the auspices of the Tsar of Russia. So now they kind of are going to show him stuff that they didn't show him in 1853.
Do they trust him still, though?
I don't think they ever trusted him,
no. I doubt it, yeah.
So, Page 41. On his second review of the Codex, Uspensky became very concerned about what he suspected were its heterodox origins, seeing distinct aspects of Arianism, which would be like Arius and what would be modern Jehovah Witness doctrine, and Apollinarianism in it, and perceiving that many important differences from the received text were not mere human errors. He records in his diary on 1850, quote, "After such a second view of this manuscript, my first opinion of her has changed, so that it seemed to me to be a production that appeared not in one holy Catholic or apostolic church, but outside of her. The Sinai Bible worried me, and it is remarkable as an example of the corruption of Holy Scripture, especially the New Testament." So does Uspensky in 1850 now, does he identify this as heterodox or heretical, coming from people who were questioning Orthodox belief, and does he identify it as contrary to or reading against the Textus Receptus, the text of the Reformation? And he says, it worries me, but again, does he ever doubt that it's old? Never. Let's read on. It was during this second visit that, as recorded in his diary, Uspensky carefully produced artwork of portions of Codex Sinaiticus from Old and New Testament, later published as color plates in 1857. Uspensky's examinations of the Codex show details of which were published in 1856. So that's before Tischendorf what? Got the rest of it, right? So he's there in 1850, he's publishing this in 1856, followed by his colored plates in 1857, are of the greatest importance. When Uspensky examined the manuscript in 1845, his dating of it was to the 5th century. So in 1845, he says this is a 5th century document, which would have been from what? The 400s. So does he think it's old?
Yeah.
He absolutely thinks it's old. He continued to describe it as a 5th century document in the color plates of it published in 1857. He finally gave it a date. He finally gave its date a range between the 5th and 7th centuries. Uspensky, who was an expert on ancient parchment manuscripts, saw nothing inconsistent about such an age and the condition of the parchment and inks, having examined parts of the Codex during the 1840s, 1850s, and the 1860s after the thing comes to where?
Russia.
Uspensky is an important witness against Dr. Cooper's thesis, since he made a detailed examination in 1845 of exactly what Tischendorf removed in 1859. Moreover, Uspensky wrote a great deal about Codex Sinaiticus in the 1860s after its arrival in St. Petersburg. But there is no hint that the Codex had undergone any significant change over the 20 years that he had been familiar with it. Okay? So, anybody have any questions? I hope you're... I got three people in here that weren't here in 2017, so hopefully you're not like bored. Mike was definitely here and a part of all this. I still have all of Mike's images that he printed off the internet for me in a folder at home. I've got a whole drawer in my office, like massive stack of stuff just on this topic that I've compiled. Okay, so I think you have the conspiratorial element. Now, the conspiratorial element is very much related on this Uspensky guy telling the truth. But when you look at what Uspensky had to say, he never thinks it's an old document. His first impression of it was that it was a poor copy from a poor exemplar that had been bound to a bigger codex. When he has more time to inspect it in 1850, he views it as heterodox origins or heretical. He identifies it as contrary to the received text. And never at any of the time, between the time he first saw it in 1845 and the time it makes it to Russia in the 1860s, does he ever say, whoa, 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 time out, this doesn't look the same as it did when I saw it in 1845. All right, any questions or comments?
Was the text of the day dated back further than that or not?
What do you mean?
The accepted Bible, was it with roots that were identified before this date? I mean, is this basically challenging just because it's an older text?
Yes. It is. It, so, because the modern theory of text criticism says older is better.
Right.
Okay?
But this is then older than what the accepted.
So that's why the date of this is so hotly debated.
Yeah.
Okay? Because they want to, if you listen to the conspiracy mindset on this, they need to find the Vatican manuscript is a fourth, also it would be the Vatican manuscript, according to, I don't even know where to write anymore, was a fourth century manuscript dating from the 300s, okay? So if Codex Sinaiticus was also that old, now the thinking is you have that one and now you can put this other one with it and now you can build a competitor text to the Textus Receptus, to the text of the Reformation. Which is why, and that's what Tischendorf desires to do. He wants to find old manuscripts. These guys are, Tischendorf and the scholars of his day were very much wedded to the idea, coming out of German higher criticism, that they needed to have a scientific approach to the text. Okay? Which means you want to find the oldest ones. The problem with that is, in my opinion, scripturally, as Paul says in his letters to the Corinthians, he says, we are not as many which corrupt the word of God. So the Bible says, was the word of God already being corrupted when Paul was still writing in the first century? So just because something is old doesn't therefore prove what?
That's right.
That it doesn't prove that it's right. It doesn't prove that it's better than what had been received and in use for centuries by the believing church. Okay. Now, I want to get to one more point possibly here before we leave on this sort of... So we've talked... What have we talked about so far? We talked about the conspiracy theory element of this. We talked about Uspensky and his testimony here. And I want to look at another thing about the new finds from 1975. So, I don't know. I hope the teachers don't need this over here, but I'm going for it. So, in 1975 now, at the monastery, some work is being done. And this wall, this ancient wall collapses. And behind the wall, there's a cache of old manuscripts. Okay? And there are something like 12 leaves, 12 pages from Codex Sinaiticus found behind that wall in 1975. Okay? So that's what we're going to talk about. Page 47 from McGrane. As Dr. Cooper points out, Tischendorf did not, in 1859, remove all of the pages of the codex that remained at St. Catherine's. Others, comprising 12 leaves and many fragments or little pieces, were lodged in a storeroom that was immured and only rediscovered in 1975, along with 1.5 tons of other manuscripts, the so-called new finds. So, there were other manuscripts that were there. They were behind this wall, and Tischendorf didn't know it. There's 12 more leaves and other little fragments there that he didn't take in 1859 because they were behind the wall, and he didn't know they were there. Is everybody following this? Okay. So, I'm not going to read this whole testimony. There's a testimony here about how the wall collapsed on May 25, 1975 at 2:15 in the afternoon, and the wall collapses and boom, there's just all the stuff behind the wall that they didn't even know was there. Okay. Now listen, is that really the way God would preserve His Word? Would God preserve His Word behind the wall in some monastery, somebody, and no one even is aware that it's there? Okay, but I digress. Okay. Dr. Cooper does not reference the above, but quotes the 1987 report, etc. I'm not going to read all this. But this is all then interpreted to support the conspiracy, right? This is what he says on page, Cooper says this on page 75 of his book. Learning that the room was about to be sealed along with a chest of manuscripts, did Tischendorf place the Sinaiticus leaves there leaves which he thought might compromise his later claims for the antiquity of Sinaiticus. It is likely, very likely indeed. So Cooper says that Tischendorf hid the 12 leaves behind a wall that would clearly show that the document's not old, so that he could abscond with the rest of it years later, so that he could pass it off as an old document. At this point, you're kind of like, okay. Well,
why would he leave them if he's worried about them?
He wouldn't. If he would have gotten this very clear, if you follow his conduct, did he want as much of the thing as he could take? And was he mad when they told him he couldn't take it, so much so that he stole the first 43? And you know he stole it. One of the ways you know he stole it is he never told anybody where he got it. He just talked about, oh, this obscure monastery somewhere. He never told anybody the name of the monastery where the thing was at because he wanted to come back later and do what? Get the rest of it. Okay? So page 48 now from McGrain. It is not at all likely because this storeroom on the fortification wall became inaccessible due to its collapse in the Sinai earthquake of 1839. Okay? The leaves of Sinaiticus discovered in 1975 had been buried and sealed there since the emergency repair work done on the fortification wall in 1839. So in 1839, there was a documented earthquake on the Sinai Peninsula. It damaged the wall of the monastery. In repairing the wall of the monastery, these parchment pieces and leaves got sealed behind the wall when they were trying to reinforce the wall and repair the damage that had happened as a result of this monastery. Okay? Now, here's the thing. The leaves of Sinaiticus discovered in 1975 have been buried and sealed there since the emergency repair work done on the fortification wall in 1839. The year Simonides arrived at Mount Athos and 5 years before Tischendorf arrived at St. Catherine's. So those parchment leaves were behind that wall since 1839, before Simonides even showed up at Mount Athos and before Tischendorf even went there for the first time. So that at a minimum, that means that Cooper's idea that Tischendorf hid him behind the wall on purpose to obscure the real age of the Codex is just absolute craziness. Okay, now you say, well, how do you know all that? Well, this is a book that we can access here via Google Books. The name of this book is The Seismicity of Egypt, Arabia, and the Red Sea, a Historical Review. So this is a historical book documenting all of the seismic activity in the Middle East. And notice there's an entry here from 1839. And notice what it says. Okay? Rubino refers to the repairs of the fortification wall of St. Catherine's Monastery in Sinai during this year following an earthquake that caused them some damage. Repairs to the museum building in 1840 are also mentioned in the following. Jadarius from 1875, Rubino 1973, and this other guy wrote a book in 1979. So there's documentable evidence that there was an earthquake in Mount Sinai that damaged the wall of the monastery. The repairs were done, trapping these 12 leaves and other things behind the wall, that the wall collapsed in 1975 and revealed 12 more leaves of Codex Sinaiticus along with other pieces of parchment, scraps, fragments, etc., that had been there since the earthquake and the wall was repaired, before Tischendorf knew of anything and before Simonides even showed up at Mount Athos to begin working on the Codex, as he claimed in the British press in 1862-1863. Okay? So let me read the rest. The 1975 discovery of these Codex Sinaiticus leaves is thus fatal to Dr. Cooper's plot, in which Simonides' alleged codex was not delivered to St. Catherine's until 1841 at the earliest and seen by Tischendorf in 1844. So this seems to be very strong evidence to suggest that was the thing there before these guys are alleging it, before Simonides alleges to have created it. Okay. Now, there's one more thing I want to share with you about this in the footnotes. This is page 48. Uspensky reports that in 1850 he learned from Vitali, the sectarian, of precious articles that had been immured before 1843. So this is Uspensky saying that one of the monks in the monastery told him that there's stuff behind the wall. The sectarian said that his predecessor, during his long illness, had been telling him that some treasures had been deposited in the wall, but in which one he did not say, but which one he did not say, and with that the secret died. This sounds like deliberate. This sounds more like deliberate deposition. I'm not sure what he's after there. However, Uspensky mentions that in 1845 the monks told him that manuscripts had been immured in the outer fortification wall. This proves to be good intelligence, since that was where this cache of manuscripts was discovered in 1975. You follow that? The monks, when he's there in 1845, they say there's stuff behind that wall. 1975, the wall collapses. And what's behind the wall? Manuscripts. Just so happens, 12 of them are part of Codex what? Sinaiticus. Okay? Now look, folks, to my great disappointment, none of these points, I am not aware where anybody has taken these points that McGrane is bringing up and systematically debunked them based upon a non-partial reading of the facts to prove that the Codex is a 19th century forgery. So when I read this stuff, this is what caused me to say I need to think long and hard about whether or not this story is true. So I don't think Simonides is trustworthy. I think he's a known liar and forger, okay? The parchment color issue doesn't seem to check out, which, by the way, is almost wholly reliant on the testimony of Uspensky in large part, who never made the kind of claims that the 19th century forgery view is making. And in the end, it doesn't matter to me if it's an old forgery or if it's a new forgery or an old corrupt manuscript. I've never accepted it as a reliant witness to the New Testament text. Okay? So, I made it halfway through the points I wanted to cover. I am going to quit a few minutes early if there's no questions, just because Dave's not here and we need to make sure we get everything set up out for church out there. But next, if you guys are going to be here, and if I can test your patience for one more time, I want to cover the remaining 3 points on this. So, anybody got any questions or comments? Mike?
Can I make one comment? A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about Mark chapter 16 and the missing verses that are in this Sinaiticus document. Well, I made some notes in my Bible back when you were talking about these 2 years ago. So, the note says 618 manuscripts contain the verses, that is, the missing verses. Early translations from the 1st and 2nd and 3rd centuries contain the verses.
Yes.
These translations predate the 2 manuscripts that do not contain the verses.
Yes. So, a reason why I don't accept it as an authentic witness to the New Testament text. Then that goes to Bart's question that he raised a little bit earlier, just a little bit more, maybe a little more directly, okay? So I think what I'm going to do then is, I mean, I've already been into this thing for 3 lessons, I might as well finish it. And so what I've done is I've gone and I've reinstated all these things along with my latest additional information on this, because I really don't want to be hiding anything from people about what I've said before, and me saying now that I think I jumped the gun on some of this stuff, and I appreciate McGrane. Now, let me say, so this is obviously, some of what I'm saying is putting me somewhat at odds with people that I would otherwise agree with about other things. But if somebody can marshal evidence to prove that McGrane's arguments are false or why they're wrong, I'm certainly willing to listen to it. and evaluate it. But right now, based upon what we can see here, I don't think there's good grounds to say this is a 19th century forgery. But that said, that doesn't mean I accept it as an authentic witness to the New Testament text. So, we'll quit right now, and as I